Okay, so hey everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Fall Global. This is where we connect with global first entrepreneurs and tech leaders from all around the world to share their experiences. Our guest today is Karim Fanous, Senior Vice President of Engineering at StrongDM. Karim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast, Karim. And could you maybe share with our audience a sort of overview of your journey, particularly highlighting your experiences in building and maybe scaling engineering organizations across various tech companies Dremio, right? And a bunch of others. So let's start with that.
Absolutely. I started my career way back then at Microsoft, actually. So I spent about a decade in software development and product management at Microsoft. And then maybe a little bit over 10 years ago, I moved to the small company side or startups. And I've done a few, almost all as head of engineering, typically joining at the Series A stage. So fairly small engineering org, probably on the order of, 10-ish software developers. And, some of these companies I stayed at through the engineering team grew from 10 to 60, 70, 80. So a big jump in size. You mentioned Dremio, that's one of them. And I was at a head of engineering at another very interesting startup called Cumulo out of Seattle, which is where I'm at. And I'm presently head of engineering at StrongDM, which also has its own interesting situations where 100% remote. So trying to scale that globally remote is a fun challenge.
Awesome. And you've got this pretty impressive background in growing engineering teams across different tech companies. And I was reading your piece, scaling an engineering team will slow you down, something like that, right? And it got me thinking about the hurdles that are not just about hiring more people, right? So what are some of the core principles or tactics you have leaned on to help your engineering teams not just grow but become more efficient and effective in those organizations?
So you're absolutely right. I found it that when you're trying to scale an engineering team, and I'm talking about meaningful scale, double or more, that becomes very hard for the present team to do. And while you might be successful in making those hires, that journey is going to be hard and it's going to be quite impactful on the current team that you have. Your productivity is going to be at best remain the same. But in time, obviously, as you onboard and make these hires, you should see material improvements in productivity, but that takes time. So the first tactic I use is I set the expectations for the team and for the rest of the organization. If we want to grow, 2-3x, that's fine, but it comes at a cost. Because the last thing you want to do is set the expectations that, look, you have 10 software developers, you're going to have 20, we're going to ship double the features. So it's not immediately, okay? And that takes time. The other tactic you want to do is, because it is very time consuming, for your current engineers, is to also set the expectations that this is very important. The work we all do in sourcing candidates, interviewing them, onboarding them, that takes a lot of time out of our day, but it is long-term very, very helpful, even though the short-term it's going to be somewhat painful. We're not actively building software. We are spending more cycles in doing interviews and onboarding the new hires we make. So you just want to make sure that internally you're aligned and understand that these things come at a cost, but that cost is very important for the long term. You also want to make sure that outside of engineering product, the CEO and sales know that this journey is in the short term going to be pretty hard, and to not expect immediate gratification that this comes later on.
And could you maybe be more specific? Could you share some examples of like big changes you've had, you have had to make in your engineering teams to keep up with the company's like roles and just make sure everyone was moving in the right direction?
So I can talk about what we're doing now at StrongDM, because we're in the middle of one of these large growth cycles where we're actively recruiting. We've made quite a bit of hires actually since the beginning of the year. And those hires span individual contributors as well as very senior management hires that we've made. And that's something I actually learned the hard way, where it's easy to look at your engineering team and say, hey, we've only got 10 software developers. We just need 30. Okay, let's go hire 20. And you forget that you need a lot of other structure around those hires that you make, strong managers. And sometimes you can find those within your current team. But sometimes you just need to go and hire outside. So layering in and making sure that you've got all the right roles and personas as you're growing is pretty important. And identify those at the outset. So, as we were growing it, when I looked at the growth ahead of us at StrongDM, some of the hires I made were meant to seed or to lay the right foundations for us to be able to grow, the team by 2 or 3x. Another change we've done is we were only hiring within North America. So most of the team is in the US. We've got a couple of folks or one person in Canada. But we also looked at now, we're 100% remote. Does it make sense to remain just in North America? There's wonderful software developers anywhere you can find them, really. And we're remote. So how do we bridge that? How do we try and get software developers outside of North America? And we hired three very, very strong, wonderful engineers out of Poland. That was our very first endeavor outside the US.
And speaking about that, I know that you have that experience in hiring globally with your current company and maybe with your previous company. So what advice would you have for those tech leaders who are looking to take their teams global? Can you maybe tell us top three things that they should keep in mind?
So the first thing you have to acknowledge is it's going to be hard. It's hard as it is getting alignment and cohesion and maintaining culture when we're all, physically co-located or at least within reasonable time zones. Once you cross the ocean and the time zones are, half a day apart, it becomes very, very challenging. So you just have to acknowledge that and have to try to reduce the risks of this move. The first thing that I do is I always try to make sure that whatever that team that is outside our core working hours is working on is completely independent. Meaning, I try to minimize. Let's say you and I are on a team. I try to minimize me waking up at 7 a.m. Having a daily stand up with you, or you staying up late at 9 p.m. or sometime late in your day to just align with me. So you want to make sure that the work that goes to that team is work that they can consume somewhat independently without a whole lot of going back and forth. The second is culture is very important. And even though we're 100% remote at StrongDM, we still spend a lot of time in, face-to-face, whether it's Zoom, sometimes even face-to-face in person and in Slack. So we work the core hours together. When you're that team on the other side of the ocean, you're not going to be able to do that. So you're going to feel distant. You want to make sure that that is not the case. And you want to make sure that you can bring both sides together. So either we go there on a regular cadence, they come to the US just to maintain that cohesion. And to maintain that, yes, we're globally spread, but we're one team, and we want to come and work together. We want to meet each other. We want to maintain that culture in spite of the time zone differences.
And talk about remote work. In your piece, The Power of Remote Work, Creating a More inclusive workplace, I guess that's the name of that piece. You highlighted how remote work can make the workplace more inclusive, right? So in your view, how does remote work redefine the playing field for people with disabilities, right? How they it can help them become a real part of the team. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious thing is, you know, your home. So you're in an environment that you're very familiar with, you're in an environment that you're very comfortable with. And that in of itself is very, very material and very helpful.
100%.
Especially if you've got any sort of disability or, you know, maybe you working from home is going to become very, very important for you. So I think that home environment is not to be underestimated. It's a comfortable environment. You know, you set it up yourself. Like you're just more familiar with it than an office. The other thing is just the lack of commute. You know, I've spoken to candidates nowadays since we're actively recruiting, and just the idea of going back to the office for some is not something that they're willing to entertain. They're spend more time with their families, spend more time with their kids, and they want to maintain that. They want to maintain, like, I see my kids more than I've ever seen them in the past 10 years because I'm with them almost all the time. And that's, I think, very, very helpful, right? It just gives this, I don't know how to best put it, but it just makes this work environment less sterile than an office. It's more personal. And you know, it kind of works for a lot of people, and for some people it doesn't. And you just have to be, you know, pretty aware of some people really benefit from being surrounded by their coworkers in an office environment. Absolutely no harm with that. And you just have to, you know, find the right talent where this mode of work works for.
Yeah, and why do you think even with all the good stuff remote work and maybe global hiring does for inclusivity, right?
Yep.
Why big companies are still so keen on getting everyone back to the office without like putting these benefits at the top of their list?
Hard to really answer that. I think, you know, I can maybe give you a couple of guesses. I mean, the first thing is they've made massive investments in infrastructure, real estate, right? And just to have all these very fancy offices sit idle or empty is probably, you know, not ideal. Another one is, I mean, we're 100% remote, but we do get together probably once a quarter. There is absolute benefit in getting a group of people to think about a problem deeply in person, and then go back and, you know, tackle these problems independently or collectively working in a remote environment. So I think this hybrid mode works very well. Even for us, we've benefited from that. And maybe some of these big companies are finding, you know, as the companies get bigger and alignment and communication start to become more of a problem, which definitely happens if you're, you know, a large public company with thousands and thousands of employees, that dealing with those in person tends to be far more efficient than thousands of Slacks and emails and Zooms. So maybe it's a combination of both.
You know, in my role at the Global Talent Agency, we interview thousands of engineers every week, and we work with very like demanding tech leaders, right? Who are looking for like superstars, in fact. And what I've noticed is that there are like two different ways they approach in terms of hiring, especially when it comes to coding tasks that candidates like take remotely, right? So, and my question is regarding like using AI during like coding challenges, right? So we have two camps. On the one hand, we have guys who are just against it, and on the other hand, we have like leaders who say that that's just a tool. I mean, what is your take on this?
So I agree, it's just a tool. I'm still going to ask you to switch off or Copilot when we're interviewing. The reason is not because I don't want you to use the tool, absolutely not. But I just want to see the candidate approach that problem from first principles unaided. And sometimes a tool like Copilot can read that prompt or, you know, analyze the source code and just give you the answer almost immediately. That defeats the whole purpose of an interview. Like, obviously, the questions that we try to ask in our interviews are very relevant to what we do. Probably not ones that you're going to find Copilot able to answer immediately. But I still want to see how the candidate is going to, you know, tackle those problems without relying on, you know, Copilot in real time. We do all our interviews live on Zoom. So it's, you know, one-on-one, you and I could be doing it for an hour. And it's sort of like a jamming session. Like sometimes, you know, you can ask like, hey, you know, I forgot how to do that. Can I, you know, can I open search on Google? Of course you can, right? But what I can is, you know, how does that work? How are you trying to solve the problem versus, you know, how adept are you at bringing Copilot into the interview? You know, we're off the camp now as switch it off during that 1 hour. And later on, if you're using it, that's fine.
And you mentioned that you hired a couple really great engineers in Poland, right, recently. So
yeah.
My question is, probably there are a couple questions regarding that. So first of all, why did you decide to hire someone specifically from Poland? Was it like a... what was the reasons for that decision? That's the first question.
Yeah. There's a few reasons. So first, I had a few Polish engineers in my previous role, so I'm familiar with that market for software developers. Poland happens to have, I think, the number one market in terms of like number of software developers in Europe. Now, in Poland nowadays is mostly, you know, local Polish software developers, as well as quite a bit of Ukrainian software developers who moved because of the war. So it's a very rich market. It also happens to be a market that is rich in systems software engineers. You know, I build infrastructure. And I'm looking for software developers who are, you know, have some experience in building databases or security products, or, you know, think of, you know, the core infrastructure that would run a business. And that's somewhat hard to find talent, but as it happens, there's quite a few of them in Poland. The other reasons are it's just relatively easy for us to go back and forth. Flights are available. There's no visas really to go between both countries, the US and here. And it's just easy to set up a business in Poland as well.
Got it. And in terms of the interview process itself, is it different for you when you interview like guys from outside of the US? Did you adapt it to somehow? Maybe did you add some additional cultural fit, like stages, or is it the same? Like you interview like guys outside of the US the same way how you interview developers from the US?
Our interview, at least for software engineers, is the same regardless of whether you've got 25 years of experience or you're fresh out of college or you're interviewing in out of Seattle, you know, one block away from me, or in Poland. So it's the same set of questions spanning, you know, the technical evaluation and non-technical. So we try to standardize it just so that it's fair and objective, so that we're able to say, you know, Vit did really, really well. Kareem, not so well.
Got it. And from the cultural perspective, did you notice any differences like between guys from outside of the US and your core team?
They haven't started yet. They'll start on the 22nd. So ask me in a few weeks. I know from previous experience that the culture can be a little bit different, but, you know, ask me in a couple of weeks and I'll tell you how, you know, whether there's any obvious changes.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. Then another question, like, throughout your career, you've held like leadership positions across various tech companies, and what are maybe some leadership lessons you have learned along the way, and how do you prioritize like continuous learning and maybe like a development within your teams? Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, that was a good question. I've been thinking about it since you shared the questions with me yesterday. So I'll start maybe talking about the lessons, and there's a couple that I think are I've learned the hard way.
Yep.
The first one is, you know, people in this role tend to be problem solvers. Like, that's what you enjoy doing, and tend to have like this bias for action. You find something broken, you want to fix it immediately. Okay. And, but you're really trying to find to what is broken. And early on in my career, especially in this role, that was my, you know, my motivation. Like, I'm, you know, head of engineering, let me look for the broken thing and jump in and try and fix it. And that could, that's not a good idea, as I learned the hard way. You really want to not be personally involved in anything, really, especially anything that's in the day-to-day life of the teams or the software engineers. You want to be building a system where, and a system is people, processes, tools, like all of the above, where all these problems are surfaced, somewhat organically prioritized. Obviously, you are involved if you have to, but you really want to push down a lot of that decision making down to the individuals and the teams. And that's actually hard to do. It's a much harder problem to solve than jumping in and trying to find out, hey, why is the build broken? Let's fix that. That's easy. Building that culture and that team where organically these things happen turns out to be a very interesting and harder problem to solve. So, you know, I now gravitate to solving that versus, you know, jumping in and finding out why is the build broken. The other lesson is, and I found that to happen as you change roles. So you move from, you know, company A to company B, and you bring in your bag of tricks. Okay, so you're going like, oh yeah, I've seen this problem before. This is how I solved it in the last company. And you try to do that very, very quickly because you're trying to show that, you know, someone made this hire, you're competent, and this is the first impactful thing you're trying to do. I think we should be, or you should be somewhat hesitant with walking into a new place and proposing any change, especially some significant change. Just sit back, observe, learn, try and understand how this place is different than where you've worked at before, because they all are. And then you can jump in and start proposing some changes. But that immediate knee-jerk reaction to, hey, you know, I'm head of engineering, I just walked in, week number two, I haven't done anything, let's go. Try to tap this down a bit.
And before we finish, you touched this a bit, but still, like, before we finish, Kerim, thinking about those tech talent out there, like, aiming to become like a VP of engineering and remote first company like yours, based on like everything you've gone through, these successes and like the tough parts, right? What advice would you share with them? How can they work towards achieving that level in their careers?
That's a hard one. I think the best advice I can give someone who wants to do that is do it. And I know that's harder to, like, you just need to find that company that takes a bet on you. And it is going to be a bet on you, especially as you're moving into that first role. Because absent that, you're just going to be, you know, trying to understand what this role is about by reading or listening to podcasts. These are all very, very helpful. But you learn a whole lot about this job while doing it. You're going to make so many mistakes. I've done hundreds of them. I still do. But that's how you learn and that's how you grow. So the best advice I can give someone who wants to do that is try to find that place. That is, obviously, you need to find a place that you would enjoy working at, but that one that is willing to take a bet on you. Because in that first role, it is a bet, okay, on both sides. And, you know, once you have that, you're going to understand what this role is. You're going to learn a whole lot more about it. You might even find out that you don't like it. And, you know, if you do like it and you grow into it, well, you know, more opportunities are going to come your way, whether within the company you're at or you decide you want to move to a different place. But you, at least you're going to have that experience under your belt.
Thank you so much, Karim, for sharing your valuable insights and experiences with us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, and yeah, we look forward to seeing what the future holds for a strong DM under your leadership.
Thank you so much for having me, Vit.